Tonight on Arena, we're at the Galway International Arts Festival once again with reviews of some of the most anticipated shows at this year's festival. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Yes, we are coming once again from the Galway International Arts Festival this evening. Tonight with me in studio, I have my two reviewers, Judy Murphy and Mary McGill, who'll be going through the festival offerings for us shortly. But you may remember that last night we broadcast from the Festival Gallery, where the work of David Mack is currently on show. And before we left the gallery yesterday, Festival Director Paul Fahey introduced us to The Oligarch's Nightmare, a work commissioned by the festival. He began by describing the work for me. Paul, we're here in the Festival Gallery. Scottish artist David Mack headlines typically strong visual arts programme, it has to be said, at the Galway International Arts Festival. He's a Turner Prize nominated sculptor and installation artist. How would you describe the work that's on display here in the Festival Gallery?
Well, so the central piece, which is the commission that David made for us this year, is called The Oligarch's Nightmare. So what you see when you walk into the gallery is a full-sized Range Rover that was about to be taken off the road.
I'm looking at it right now because it's just over your shoulder. It's a phenomenal piece of work. Just describe it for us.
So there's a black Range Rover that's kind of bursting out of the floor, bonnet flying off, doors kind of distorted, wheels twisted around, and in front of it, it's just exploded, is a 30-foot-tall explosion of flame and fumes coming out of the ground up into the rafters of the gallery. So it's an incredible piece. It's almost kind of like pop art, like, in a way, kind of, you know, there are echoes even of things like he was chatting about the old, like, Warlord magazines, or things like his memory of seeing Dr. No when he was young, and an amazing explosion at the end. So these are the kind of things that were in his head. But like, he comments a lot as well on, and it's also the Range Rover is a black Range Rover, but the explosion is this beautifully painted orange and yellow and white and black flame and smoke.
Yeah.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And then the floor.
I was going to ask you about the floor, because yesterday when Colm Meaney and Brenda were here with us, they immediately looked at the floor and went, look at the floor, it's as if it's been ripped up. Just explain what that is.
So it looks like the impact of the bomb or whatever it is that's made the Range Rover explode has also broken open the floor. So it appears like it looks like an earthquake.
Yeah.
The cement is shattered, but that's all created by David and the team.
Yeah, so the cement is shattered, and, you know, like those steel rods that would hold concrete floors together, there's some of them sticking up.
There's some of those sticking up, bits of pipe and all that. So it's like the impact has just happened, the explosion has just happened before you see it.
And it struck me that it kind of speaks to some of the other pieces that are in the other anterooms, which is this kind of aspect of man's impact and interaction with the environment, and quite often destruction of that environment.
Yeah, and he's also talking about kind of current situations in terms of kind of war, and like he's very interested in kind of in mass consumption and in overconsumption and stuff that people use that we don't need. So, like, traditionally he's been known for using things like, you know, tens and thousands of newspapers or lots of tires. He uses a lot of recycling, great in terms of, you know, circular economy and all that kind of thing. But he does talk about kind of the grossness of our mass consumption. And then this, The Oligarch's Nightmare, also echoes kind of the grossness of wealth and, you know, how people kind of show off that kind of stuff. But, you know, David grew up in Fife in Scotland, and he was the son of a coal miner. So he was surrounded by that industry, but also by things like metalwork industry, like dockyards. So it was all kind of like big, loud machinery and everything that you think of when you think of things that are, you know, that type of industry. And that still has a very strong element in the making of his work and in the visual, in what his work actually looks like.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about one of the pieces that's inside, which is an homage to the white van drivers, which is effectively four vans, kind of like a tower built, like
yes,
a tower. What was at play there?
That particular piece he's making for Chiswick Roundabout in London, so that hasn't been installed as of yet. But some of the other pieces that are in that other room in the gallery are models of stuff that he has realised in similar kind of scale to The Oligarch's Nightmare. For example, the freight container with the two sumo wrestlers
on either
side. Yeah. That's a great fun piece, and he did that in somewhere in New Yorkshire. And then he's another piece, the Temple of Tyres, which is like the, you know, Pantheon of River in Greece, which is phenomenal, and that's made from like tiny little like rubber tires. But when he made the big scale version of it, he did it on top of freight containers, maybe I don't know, like 100 freight containers that form the foundation, and then a huge temple made from tractor tires.
So the one that we're seeing here is like a model of
a
that
model,
much,
the maquette is, yeah,
much bigger work. But it says something that he has used that very contemporary thing of the tractor tire to build a very ancient thing like a Greek temple. What do you think is at play in that type of conversation?
Well, I mean, again, like it's he's like he's begin to reusing and recycling and whatever. So like the as I mean, I suppose like it also like he's very interested in form and like they were the kind of the perfect yeah. thing to create. That's finally
couldn't let you go without mentioning Cloakroom, the 10th of immersive theatre installation between yourself and Enda Walsh.
Yeah.
We're in another room.
Another room. It's 1972. This time we're in a cloakroom, like a coat check of a ballroom. So when you walk into the room, there's white square boxes when you walk in, just very contemporary looking. You open a door, you're in this kind of double width corridor, you see the doors going into the dance hall at the end of the corridor, and then through an arch on the right is the cloakroom. And we hear the voice of Zara Devlin tell us, she plays a young woman in her early 20s, kind of telling us her love story. It's very, very beautiful.
All right. Enda Walsh's Cloakroom is at the Shed in Galway until the 30th of July. David Max, the Oligarch's Nightmare is here at the Festival Gallery in Galway until the 30th of July. Full details on giaf.ie. So here we are then, back in Galway, as I said, at the Galway International Arts Festival, and it's reviews this evening with me in studio, Mary McGill and Judy Murphy, and we'll be talking about, let's start in fact with the Cillian Murphy theme that Paul Fahey finished with just before the break there. He was talking about Cloakroom, one of the installations, the ongoing installations, but the big play at this year's festival, or one of the big plays at this year's festival, is Bedbound, featuring Colm and Brenda Meaney as dad and daughter. They were with us on the programme yesterday, and very interesting to hear the two of them speak about the play indeed. Just maybe, Mary, you would give us the basics. It's a classic Enda Walsh setup, this, but just give us the bones of it.
Yeah, so we've got father and daughter, and they are bound in this room, and the single piece of furniture in this room is a nasty, decaying looking bed. And that is where the action starts. That's where the action remains. Around this bed, we seem to have walls, both literally and figuratively. And father and daughter are engaged in monologues and dialogues between the two of them. And so right from the get-go, Sean, we have this sense of being trapped with each other, being trapped psychologically, being trapped in the world. And of course, you know, Bedbound produced in 2000.
Initially,
all the themes that we associate now with, you know, the Walsh phenomenon are there.
Yeah.
In raw form, it has to be said, but they are there. They are present and they've been worked over. And I think for people who have come to the festival over the years and seen productions between Galway and Landmark, you know, and are familiar with Walsh's work through that experience, they will connect those dots. For me, it was very interesting to see it performed in that context.
And the other side of that is, Judy, that in fact, perhaps as Enda Walsh's work has gone on, the narrative thread that runs through the plays becomes less and less. In this, there's still the semblance of a kind of a story being told, which just involves Cork and Dublin.
There is a semblance of a story. It's a surreal story. It's a bizarre story. There's a lesson kind of really being told that Cork men should stay in Cork, especially when it comes to business, that God is definitely from Cork. And it's got Enda Walsh's humour, and it's got a very kind of droll humour, but it's also the language. A lot of people the night I was there, the humour actually is quite juvenile. I suppose it is a 2000 play, so he was a much younger man, but there's a lot of humour in it, and you think, gosh, that's kind of like, yeah, that doesn't happen in his work.
Yeah.
Anymore.
It hasn't got the humour maybe isn't as overt and as obvious perhaps as it is in this piece. The other aspect of things here, and I was astonished in some ways when Colm Meaney started talking about Trump as one of his models for this, clearly not in Enda Walsh's mind back in 2000, but we're talking about capitalism. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about a kind of essentially an anti-capitalist tract here? Is that what we have? Is that to the fore, Mary?
I think there is an element of that. I think there's also an element. Judy, I think, hit the nail on the head there when she mentioned language. I think there's a real, Beckett influence to this play around, and I think you can apply this to capitalism or you can apply it to the human condition in general. And I think, you know, there's quite a specific relationship in Ireland between shame in society and how that impacts the individual. But these two characters really struggle to make their inner worlds cohere with their outer worlds. And what I mean by that is they talk a lot, but they find expression very, very hard. So they say lots of things, but actually articulating what they need and what they feel is difficult. So much so that this dad character, you know, he cannot make peace with the world. He can't exist within it. You know, he can't enjoy it. He can't feel stable or secure in it.
But not surprising when you consider his background, maybe. Because when he goes back into his memory and that they fill the silence with torrents of words. And then every now and again, he'll come to a point in his memory where something is so outrageously bad that he has done or that has happened around him, that the words just stops, and sometimes he hides under a duvet or he crawls into the bed because he can't face the reality
of...
So
essentially the words are a way of not facing the past to a large extent, this, but they're spending their time avoiding the past in some ways. What about the performances here, Judy? I mean, Colm Meaney clearly is the household name. Brenda Meaney is his daughter, coming from that very theatrical and acting-bound family. How do they work together?
I thought they were really good together. He might be the big name, but to me, she was the one who just, she was magnetic. Her role is pretty much bedbound. He moves around the stage. She is confined to the bed, and she inhabits different personalities, different characters back in the day from their previous life. And she just, the way she moves within that confined space and the gestures and the pain that she has, and she is trying to find out why her life has ended up in this way. And you are with her every step of the way in that. He's very good, but to me, she was extraordinary, and possibly not knowing her before as well.
Yeah, I suppose that she is the fresher face in that respect. How did it work for you in terms, and she's living her life through this big romance novel, so there's something terribly sad about that. How did the dynamic work with you? I mean, the Landmark and Galway International Arts Festival, they cast a father and daughter in a father and daughter role. Sounds like they got it right.
I think they absolutely did, and I would agree. I thought Brenda was just electric in this role, so much so that afterwards I was like, what else has she been in? Because I really want to see what else she has been in. She really stood out. And yes, you know, she has to perform a really complicated, you know, it's one role, but within it there is so much going on, and she really inhabits everything that she does. She broke my heart, I have to say. All she right. truly did.
Right, so it sounds like you both thoroughly enjoyed this. It's a recommendation from both of you. Yes, a recommendation from both of you. That's Bedbound by Anda Walsh. It runs through until July the 29th at the Bailey Allen Hall. And of course, it comes to the Olympia in Dublin in the month of August. I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit more about it at that point. All right, let's go on to another of the big shows, and one that we featured on the show last night as well. This is The Pulse, from the Australian acrobatic choir group that have come to Ireland. Just explain what we're looking at in this. We had the director, Darcy, was on with us last night. Of course, I was still in a bad mood with him about them beating the Irish team. So I hope I wasn't too nasty. However, tell us what they're giving us in The Pulse.
The Pulse is 30 acrobats and a 30-strong choir. And it is in, and I suppose to begin with, to mention the transformation of the Kingfisher space in the University of Galway, which the crew of Galway Arts Festival have transformed into a seater of almost 1,200 capacity seated venue. And the 60 people in the show emerge from all sides of the theatre and all sides of the auditorium, and they take their place on the stage. The choir is dressed in black, and the other performers are dressed in kind of grey or cream, so they're very distinguished from each other. And then it starts off really slowly. They shape and they form, they lie on the ground, they get up, they move.
And are the choir moving as well?
The choir
Everybody's moving at this stage.
And then the choir, sometimes they stand back at the back, sometimes they form at the side, sometimes they intermingle, and then the acrobats start to build slowly from the ground up. And the choir is singing in Spanish first and then in English, 1-2, 1-2. And so the acrobats start going one on top of the other and making little pillars and then higher pillars. And then the pillars, the individual pillars, come together to form arches.
And this is a human arch. This is an arch made of human bodies.
Human bodies, yeah. And it's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's just a thing of beauty. And the whole way through, you have the choir and the music and the singing with them. And it is just... what the human body can achieve in terms of strength, in terms of flexibility, the human voice, where it can bring you. There's one solo performance that goes on for minutes. And I mean, it just brings you to such places and it enters kind of your soul nearly. And what can be done when people trust each other? And what I only learned afterwards was that this show had come as a result of COVID, when the performers couldn't work together. And when they could, eventually they kind of got together and they put all of this energy into creating this piece. And it's really, I mean, trust, I think. I mean, they're so brilliant physically and they are.
Is there any kind of a story, or is it a feast for the eyes in terms of movement and a feast for the ears in terms of sound, and don't go looking for stories here?
Well, I'm desperate at these kind of things because sometimes I struggle to find stories and I don't find them because I'm kind of, you know, theatre. But I just sort of thought, let's go with it. And it's...
Go ahead.
It's such a sense for the eyes and the ears. Such a sensory experience. And really, I don't think... And the other thing that struck me the other night as I was sitting there on Tuesday night, in a room with 1,100 other people, give or take, I thought, how amazing that we're all back here in theatre like this with such spectacular sensations in front of us. And it was, again, as I say, it was only afterwards that I learned that it had emerged from COVID. So it was just, loved it. Yeah, and the lighting was fantastic.
Well, I'm going to that at 8 o'clock tonight. So now you've made me even more excited to be going to it. And it is just one tonight, a performance tonight and a performance tomorrow night at the Festival Theatre in the Kingfisher Festival Theatre in the grounds of UCG. And it sounds quite amazing indeed. That is The Pulse. Let's move on then. This is a show I saw in Dublin some time back. Little like Bedbound, in fact. How to Be a Dancer in 72,000 Easy Lessons. In this case, we have a husband and wife team performing together and telling effectively, the husband and wife being Colm Keegan Dolan and his wife, Rosha, and they're effectively telling his story and his route towards dancing, Mary.
Yes, it is. I didn't know what to expect going into this. So Michael Keegan Dolan, directed by Rachel Poirier and Adam Silverman. And I left feeling, if Bedbound is a challenging watch, and I think we were saying that it was, this is a transcendent one. And I mean that in the best possible way. If dance is about joy, and I think this is what 72,000 Easy Lessons is saying and making a great case for, then I left there full of it. So we meet Michael Keegan Dolan, and himself and Rachel are on stage for the whole performance. And he begins with his life, early life in Dublin, this beginning, this first step towards becoming a dancer. It didn't start the way you would think. He was a boy with pigeon feet, growing up in a hyper-masculine environment, a fee-paying school where the insistence was that, you know, you played things like rugby.
Yeah.
He didn't want to play rugby, but he tried. He tried. But while all that was going on, he had a very cool friend, and the friend was a great dancer. And when they would go out to discos, you know, he noticed that this got them noticed. And he enjoyed the dancing as well, even though he was threatened by the rugby lads saying, you know, look, at the girls are looking at you, you'd want to stop that, whatever it is that you're doing, you know. But he didn't stop. And when he was 19, he began to take ballet lessons in London. Now, this was the 80s, 70s, 80s. So, you know, the IRA bombing campaign is going on at this time. And he becomes to, you know, get this sense of himself as an Irish person, somebody who's discriminated against in that context. And he begins to fall in love with dance, fall in love with women, fall in love with the possibilities of what can be through this medium.
And also in the midst of all of this, then, there's a family secret that, well, it's not a secret as such, but it's not much talked about in his family. And he comes across this connection right back to the War of Independence.
Yes. When he tells his parents he wants to be a dancer, his father says to him, not even an actor. Like, this idea that you would want to, you know, pursue this line of work. But as it turns out, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's actually quite a profound familial connection to the arts.
Yeah, and in and around the period of the Cultural Revolution, if you want to call it the culture, but the cultural aspect of our rising in 1916. The moment in this that I remember most, and I think it was one for you as well, Rachel Poirier, I don't know what I was calling her earlier on, Rachel Poirier, her dancing to Ravel's Bolero. Oh. It's an incredible moment. And it's a recording that Michael Keegan Dolan's mother gave to him, one of the first pieces of music he gave to her. And it's this specific recording that he uses within it. But the dancing is astonishing here.
It's astonishing, isn't it? And isn't that beautiful? I didn't know that. That's really lovely.
Yeah, he told me that. I thought, yes, it was a beautiful detail.
Absolutely. And you know what's more beautiful about it is that as Rachel dances and she dances, it's an incredible piece of music and she interprets it. You can't take your eyes off her, but he watches her as well on stage. He watches
absolutely
her.
Absolutely still.
Absolutely still, but also so full of admiration that this journey he's telling us about has taken him to her, you know. And I should say as well, Michael Keegan-Dolan isn't Olivia nominated, you know, choreographer. He has come a long way. He described coming home at Christmas and people would say to him, well, what do you do? And he would say, well, I'm a dancer. And immediately they'd say to him, oh, river dance. Because that's the only form of dance they knew. And so he would try to explain, no, how do you explain? And I will say, you know, I can imagine people maybe reading about this show and thinking, oh, I don't know anything about dance. You don't need to know anything about dance to enjoy this. You really, really don't. I mean, it got a standing ovation and it was the most organic standing ovation I've been at in a long time.
Yeah.
You know, people were waiting for it.
And there's a very clear story. It is telling the story of his route into dancing. So a very strong recommendation is what you're giving on this one, Miriam McGill. Mm-hmm. That's How to Be a Dancer in how many thousand easy lessons? 72,000 easy lessons. It is at the Black Box Theatre here in Galway as part of the Arts Festival. Three shows left, 7 p.m. this evening. You're not going to get to that one at this point, but two tomorrow, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. So a matinee and evening performance of How to Be a Dancer in 72,000 easy lessons. Staying in the world of theatre for the time being, Judy Duncan, this is every brilliant thing. Duncan Macmillan has had a worldwide hit with this play, in fact. And when you think of the themes, you kind of go, these are difficult themes that you're going to try to get people into watching theatre. We all want to be challenged in thoughts, but we also want to be entertained. Tell us about the themes behind every brilliant thing. First of all, Judy.
It's we entered the auditorium and there's a woman played by Claire Barrett in this production by Decadent Theatre. And she tells the story of her as a 7-year-old child whose mother suffers from depression and has attempted suicide. And it travels through that, through her own life. But when you go into the auditorium, she comes in, and the theatre is small, it's Nuns Island. So it's 100-seater, but it's full and it's sold out pretty much, I think. And she hands everybody, or many people there, a piece of cardboard with something printed on it. And she asks them, when she calls out, there's a number and something printed on it. And she asks, when she calls out that particular number, will they read out what's on the card? And it could be something like ice cream. It could be something like Tony Bennett singing or, you know, whatever.
Which will have a particular relevance.
So it could be something like that. And this is a list that she drew up as a child to try and make her mother realise what there was in life that was worth living for.
Now, the drawing up of the list and the idea of them being on the cards, I'm with you so far, but I realise that you did say there that the audience members get a card, which suggests to me they're going to have to do something with that card.
Actually, that's kind of the easy part in terms of if you get a card and you're asked to read out your card, that's fine. But there's a serious amount of audience engagement or involvement in this, but it's done beautifully and it's done kindly. The first guy she calls up, she asks, as the 7-year-old or slightly younger than the 7-year-old, is a vet, and she wants him to euthanize her dog, who's known as Sherlock Bones. So she folds up a jacket and he is to inject the needle in, and he doesn't do it right the first time, but he gets it right the second time, and it goes on from there. She calls somebody else up to be dad, and dad drives him to the hospital on the evening that her mother has been admitted after the suicide attempt. And then there's all these other characters. There's a teacher at school who has a dog, or who has... She talks to the teacher, but she talks to the teacher through the dog. So the teacher has to hold up her... I don't want to say too much, but it's just brilliant. And it's funny. And the way she interacts, and every night it's a different audience. So every night it's a different person who's brought up.
So the cards can come in any order to her. So if you go one night and you go the next night, you might see totally different stories being told and acted out, different order.
It's pretty much the same story, but how it will unfold in some ways depends on, we'll say, how Dad interacts, or how the vet interacts, or how the teacher interacts. She has to improvise to go with their response to her. And then she has to segue back into her own narrative as well. And she's just brilliant at the improvising. And at the we grow up with her. She continues the list throughout her life. There's a young man she meets in college, and their story of romance and how it unfolds is just gorgeous. There's a lecturer who has to read a piece from Goethe, and the book is handed to this woman who's just a random member of the audience, and she goes with it, and it's brilliant. It's just, it's a fabulous music as well. There's loads of music, and there's live music in it. And music is intrinsic to it. And it, even though it's about suicide, even though it's about depression, even though the subjects are heavy, there are a couple of themes in it, a couple of messages. One is for people in the media like me, as in when you're reporting suicide and
it's
stuff like that.
I saw that today, and immediately I went off looking for the guidelines on how you should present something in and around the theme of suicide.
Yeah, especially covering inquests and things that you don't, you know, dramatise it. You don't see how it's, you know, made easier or whatever. You keep to the bare minimum in terms of covering it so as not to be glamorising it or encouraging or, you know, any of the difficult things. But she does it. She does it in such a way, Claire Barrett, that she brings you along, and it's funny as well as sad.
A lot resting on the shoulders rather of Claire Barrett, I would have thought then, in this performance.
Oh, she's immense.
Yeah, okay, says it all.
Yeah.
Okay, and that is running Every Brilliant Thing at Nuns Island Theatre right through until the end of the festival, right through until Sunday the 30th. Silent physical theatre piece, just as we come towards the nook that Aireachtas the Clog, Mary, maybe give us the essence of what's involved in Not a Word. I mean, it's kind of there in the title, isn't it?
Yeah, Not a Word indeed, Sean. We have an absolutely beautiful piece of musical and physical theatre here. It's a simple story in many respects. An Irish labourer, presumably sometime in the last century, arrives back to his flat, very, you know, spare flat, of an evening, covered in dirt from the building sites. He proceeds to, you know, get undressed, try and make himself comfortable. And coming through in waves and in little movements, and of course through the music, this beautiful violin playing, we get a sense of the profound loneliness and exile that is his everyday existence in London, because we can hear Big Ben at one stage in the background. This unnamed labourer is wearing a mask made of clay. And if you can imagine, his body is covered in dirt from the building site. So at once it is speaking to that reality of this man who makes his living in dirt, also to the soil of the country that he misses, Ireland, which is evoked very effectively throughout. But as the piece progresses, the mask changes and shifts.
Okay, I'll hold you on that one.
Okay.
We'll tease about how does the mask change and shift, and who is this character, and what are we actually watching? And so here we are back in studio, and still sitting opposite me are my two reviewers for tonight, Mary Miguel and Judy. And let you have seen this show that Mary set up for us, Not a Word, as well, Judy. So we know that it's a labourer, we know that there are some music, and that he has a mask on, but that this mask is going to change as the piece progresses. So you take it up from that point, Judy, maybe, and explain to us what's happening.
The thing about the mask, and what was amazing about Raymond Keane, who is a brilliant physical performer.
Single physical performer and the musician at the side.
And
as well.
Alton O'Brien from Slow Moving Cloud, who's amazing on the music. And it has two different fiddles, depending on whether we're listening to the character listening to records, which evoke his life back in Ireland, or living his life as it's kind of a soundtrack to his life in London, which is far less cordant, say. It's quite a discordant thing. So all you can see is the body and the hands. And then suddenly he's about to have a change in his life. So he washes his face. He does all sorts of things with the mask. The mask reminded me, made of clay, as Mary said, but like something that was sculpted out of limestone with a nose and eyes. It is just such a piece of crag. And then as the piece progresses and he's looking like he might move, he's looking like things will change, he's looking like his life will get a little bit better, the mask starts to shift a little and become less solid. But then what we hope will happen It doesn't look like it's going to happen in the end.
Yeah, well, and you can feel that you're being careful not to give the story away, as it were. This is a story about emigration. Mm. Well, you mean, we sense it's an Irish labourer in London. Mm. To what extent is it speaking to immigration as well, and perhaps showing us sideways to maybe see things from the other, from a different point of view, Mary?
Yeah, I mean, Raymond King gives a beautiful speech at the end about the nature of exile, and I think it absolutely touches on those points. What dislocation does to a person, however it occurs. And I think, you know, to go back to that idea of the mask and the disintegration of the mask, you know, it's also, the mask reflects this man's soul, this man's connection to his roots. And that's really what he's losing, what he's trying to reestablish, what he's grasping for, but just can't reach.
Okay, so this again, it seems as if the theatre shows this year have done very well. This is a recommendation from both of you. Is it Mary first?
Yeah, I think Brew Theatre have something really special here. It was in the Bank of Ireland Theatre in NUIG, which is small. I think that made it beautifully intimate as well.
And Judy, you would agree?
I think it's one of the most thought-provoking, profound pieces I've seen in a long time. It blew me away.
So that's 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. tomorrow. I won't get to see it because I'm going to see the two Druid shows. I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. But I'm hoping that might have legs. Perhaps
you both
suggested it would have. Mary, you've been to see two. That's Not a Word, by the way, is the title of the show featuring Raymond Keane. Let us finish with the visual art shows. We mentioned David Mack's Oligarch Nightmare, which Paul Fahey described to us earlier in the show. You were impressed by this, I think, Mary?
I wasn't. I was impressed by it, Sean. I was troubled by it as well. Okay. I mean,
Troubling, actually. It speaks to the environment in a way I hadn't expected.
Absolutely. We've had a summer of extreme weather in Europe. And I mean, I think Mac he's talking to a lot of things, but I think he's absolutely talking to the consequences of consumerism. So as Paul Fahey said earlier on, you know, you have these manettes, these small sculptures made out of white delivery vans, made out of cargo freights. And of course, all of this speaks to the nature of capitalism that we have now, which is you can order something online and it's with you tomorrow morning. We cannot see the consequences of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also everywhere. My favourite part of it is a print. Initially, when you glance at it, it looks like a beautiful Christmas card. But if you look closely, in the background of this ginger perfect village, one of the houses is exploding. And all of the people out skiing and walking are looking, going, oh dear. So
runs at the Festival Gallery through until July the 29th, the end of the festival. And one of them that I went to see today as well. Lovely. It's a real nighttime feel to this. Whistling in the Dark, which is a real Tom Murphy feel off the title.
Yes.
This is Ruby Wallace at the Galway Arts Centre, Mary.
I absolutely love Ruby Wallace's work. I think I let out a little cheer when I saw it included in the festival this year. I came across it first in Bones in the Attic, that fantastic kind of review of feminist art that was on the Hugh Lane last year. Whistling in the Dark, Ruby just fantastic pictures. You see pictures from her series, A Woman Walks Alone at Night with a Camera in this, but you'll also see more recent work as well, installations, stencils, all kinds of things. If you're not familiar with her work, she's a Galway-based artist, photographer, I'd really recommend it. You're so right. It captures a strange beauty of everything nocturnal.
Yeah, there's one room where there are four screens with nighttime pictures on them, and it's very dark. And the minute you go in there, you start whispering.
Yes.
You can't talk out loud when you're in there.
Absolutely. And she has so much to say about, you know, the night has traditionally been a space where women aren't supposed to go.
Yeah.
So to go and make art out of it, that's so confronting. And gets you to reconsider what the night is for and what it could be. I mean, I just love her work. So great to see her featured.
Okay, so that's Whistling in the Dark from Ruby Wallace at the Galway Arts Centre. Thank you so much to both Mary McGill and Judy Murphy for bringing us in all of their thoughts on the shows at the Galway International Arts Festival. As I said, I am going to see two of the Druid trilogies tomorrow. I've already seen Julian and the Peacock, saw that last night. Not going to say what it was like, but I'm very excited to see the next two, let me say that. And I'm also very excited about the fact that we will be back here in Galway on Thursday, July the 27th, to have an audience with the Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall Theatre to celebrate this new production of Druid O'Casey. And you are invited to come along. It is, of course, the Sean O'Casey's Dublin Trilogy, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman and Juno and the Peacock. Those are the three plays that are being performed during the festival. And then they head out on a national and international tour. But on Thursday next, 27th, 3 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre, we will be there. I'll be on stage, joined by the creative team behind Druid O'Casey, including director Gary Hines, And the cast of the three plays, 17 members of cast, I believe I'm going to have on stage with me next Thursday. I'm looking forward to that enormously. Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Fay, Zara Devon, the list goes on and on. Be talking to them and the director and creative team about the whole process of bringing Druid O'Casey to the stage and the story that it tells about the formation of this state, because it very much is from 1916 through until 1922. So that's a special Arena Druid at the Arena Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway next Thursday, July the 27th, 3 to 4pm. And if you want to find out about tickets and how to be there, go to druid.ie. And so to film reviews to finish up on this Friday evening bumper week. It has been the release of two of the most anticipated movies, I think it's safe to say, of the year so far. Barbie is Greta Gerwig's take on the adventures of the legendary doll as she leaves Barbie land and experiences life in the, quote, real world. And in Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan, Cillian Murphy plays the scientist who was involved in the Manhattan Project and gave America the atomic bomb. Finally, My Name is Alfred Hitchcock, feature documentary by filmmaker Mark Cousins, which explores the work of Hitchcock through a different lens. Tara Brady, John McGuire have been to see the movies. They join me this evening. We'll go to Barbie first of all, which has already created quite a buzz at its Irish premiere on Wednesday's fans dressed up in various shades of pink. But does it live up to all the hype? Well, maybe Tara, if you're going to take on Barbie the doll, there are so many versions of Barbie the doll. You've got quite a task on your hands. How has Greta Gerwig approached telling the story of Barbie?
Well, that's exactly the problem. There are many Barbies, and one of the key sort of concepts of the movie is that, you know, all of these women are Barbie, and Barbie is all of these women when you're talking about all the different versions, because of course, you know, Barbie in various guises has been an astronaut and a physicist and a doctor and on all of these things. So it has to do those things. And I mean, one of the really interesting things, one of the best moments in the film is a speech that America Ferrera gives in the film where she talks, and it won't spoil it, but it talks about the contradictions of modern femininity, and Barbie the movie not only has to embrace all of those contradictions, but it has to embrace all of the contradictions of Barbie, and those are not like they're considerable contradictions, because it has to be simultaneously a film that is a product, after all, from Warner Brothers, from Mattel, from, you know, from this giant toy company, but it also is this satire of corporate culture, and it has to depict Barbie and all of the Barbies and everything that Barbie means, and Barbie means a lot. She's feminism, and but she's also pink, and she's stupid, and she's girly, and you know, she was, as the makers of Barbie love to tell you, the first female presidential candidate in the United States. But she's consumerism, and she's this impossible bodily ideal, but she's also aspirational. So Gerwig, working who has this a tremendous interpreter in Margot Robbie, by the way, has to channel all these ideas into a film that has to work for adults and for kids. It has to have, and it's all sorts of things. There's a lot going on here. There's pop music, there's choreography, there's a big power ballad performed by Ryan Gosling, and then you have this Barbie like journey into the real world, which turns into this kind of very, very light, good natured satire of sort of men's rights activism, and turns into this contemplation of rather weighty themes.
Let me go to John on yes. What happens then when they get to the real world, John. Tara touching on it there, this idea that they get into the weighty themes, and I think it kind of turns things on its head by turning Ryan Gosling's Ken into a fighter for men's rights. We have a right to the patriarchy is the argument he's bringing back.
It is funny, Sean, when Ken discovers the patriarchy and that men are really only interested in trucks and horses and... What else does he get? A hat. I think he gets a new hat.
And he dresses up like Sylvester Stallone.
He gets a fur coat, of course. And, you know, this is funny, but this is the thing about the film, is that there are so many layers here at work, and that we have to parse our way through them as we're watching them in this, you know, day glow, eye-popping production design, this huge setting, this huge stage. We have Busby Berkeley dance Dance Us, we have Kubrick references, we've got references to Toy Story and Clueless, and you're trying to parse all of this out at the time that they're actually giving you a lecture about how awful the world is, how this doll is 60 years old and it's, the world really isn't that different to what it was 60 years previous. And like Tara said, the America Ferrera speech that come with her young teenage daughter, that speech, when it arrives, is literally a drop the mic moment. It's like, oh, well, that's what they're getting at. That's what they're getting at. And all of this really is to distract you, I suppose, from remembering that you're watching a $100 million advertisement for a $1 billion toy. That's the only drawback that I had with Barbie, is that they don't burrow into that. They do attempt to satirize corporate culture, and particularly with Will Ferrell as the CEO of Mattel. But it's so good-natured, I suppose, in its way, that they're not drilling into what these kind of, when they say inspirational and aspirational for Barbie, what you're actually covering up is, as Tara said, these body issues, these kind of unrealistic expectations that women have. And Ferrera's speech does that, and you get to that moment, but then there's still 25 minutes of movie to go, and it tends to drift.
Let's have a listen to a clip. This is Margot Robbie as Barbie, as we've said, and she starts to malfunction and she has to consult the doll that is called Weird Barbie, played by Kate McKinnon, as to what to do.
Some things have been happening that might be related. When my world shakes. Cold shower. Ooh. Falling off my roof. Ah! And my heels are on the ground.
Flat feet!
Have to do.
You have to go to the real world.
You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours. The first one, the high heel. You have to want to know. Okay? Do it again.
There we go. That's Margot Robbie and Kate McKinnon in a scene there from Barbie. As I listen to that, Tara, I get it feels like I've been eating a lot of candy floss and that it's quite kind of sugary in that respect. Is it a kind of a rapid fire piece of filmmaking, or do we get moments of respite where the debates are allowed to kind of come to the top in a gentle way?
I think all of it's very gentle. I mean, all of it is so good natured, and even the kind of satirical points it makes are so good natured. You couldn't, you know, walk away and go, oh, that was woke nonsense. But I'm sure the people who like to say things are woke nonsense will say so anyway. It's very, very good hearted. But there is actually warmth to it, because and there's a very nice balance of things, because you get really obviously big camp pink moments. That goes without saying, but you also get sort of knockabout comedy with Will Ferrell, and then you get this lovely almost tear jerking performance from Rhea Perlman playing Ruth Handler, who's Barbie's creator, who has these like conversations with Barbie about her hopes and dreams for Barbie, and it's actually quite moving, and also Barbie's experiences in the real world are actually quite moving, because of course it comes as a desperate shock to realise that not everybody loves Barbie in the real world.
The team here, Greta Gerwig as director and her co-writer, Noah Baumbach, obviously partners in real life, have they managed to tread that very difficult line that it is to present Barbie with all of the pitfalls, John?
Well, that's the thing, Sean. This considerable craft has been expended here in making both sides of the position that Barbie holds feel true at the same time. It's a Schrodinger test that Oppenheimer would surely recognise. It has to be this bright bubblegum pop movie, but it also has to address real issues in the real world. It does that skillfully and charmingly, effortlessly charming in many ways. And it might be a bit ridiculous, but the excitement that the film generates, and that, you know, we're talking about, we've been talking about this for 6 months. So it doesn't really even matter what Barbie is like. Just going to the cinema as an event, that's hugely important at the moment. And you imagine the studio heads waking up on Monday morning to this huge global box office thinking, you know, maybe the actors and the writers that are involved in this film are important, and maybe this has something that streaming cannot do. And maybe Barbie has another job to do to help us to try to get over the bump that cinema's in at the moment.
And outside of the writing and directing aspect from Gerwig and Baumbach, what about the performances, Tara?
Oh, the performances are all great and all great fun and really like beautifully cast. It has this obviously huge range of people, but Margot Robbie is absolutely outstanding. Like she really brings heart to it, and that's what it is. It's a film that really wears its heart in its
sleeve.
And
I'd stand up for Ryan Gosling's Ken as well.
Absolutely fantastic.
He's much more involved in the film than I expected him to be, and he's absolutely note perfect in every expression that he makes. Yeah. And he has to do some ridiculous stuff, and he does it absolutely superbly.
When the first reviews came out and people were saying Ryan Gosling deserves an Oscar, I was thinking, well, that's hyperbole, but actually, I could see it.
Yeah. Okay, right. Stars from you, first of all, then, Tara.
Well, it's funny because it's a total opposite thing for Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer has gotten less the more I think about it, and Barbie's gotten more the more I think about it. I think it's like nothing short of miraculous when you think about what she's done with it. So 4.5 for me.
4.5. And what are you saying, John? Just stars, nothing else?
Just stars, 4 stars, Sean. I really
four
enjoyed
stars
it.
From you. Okay, let's move on then to our second film this evening, the one you've just mentioned, both of you. Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan, biopic about the contributions of the American scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer to the Manhattan Project, effectively the establishment, the making of the atomic bomb. This is Christopher Nolan's 12th feature. John tells the story of the creation of the atomic bomb. It's a long story that
it's
he
a 3-hour
sets
story,
about telling
yeah.
here.
It's a 3-hour story, and it's funny they called it the Trinity Project, the bomb itself, and there's three interlocking and overlapping points in time that Nolan is concerned with here, before, during, and after the creation of the bomb through the conduit of J. Robert Oppenheimer, who is a theoretical physicist. He's magnetically played by Cillian Murphy. I'll just say this is Murphy's best performance of his career, no doubt about it. And this kind of looping chronology, it's reminiscent of Memento and Inception. Nolan plays with time, and it carries forward the central idea from his last film, Tenet, which is what if humanity could uninvent this horrible, terrible technology that's come about. And the whole film is laden with these philosophical import, this stiffening drama, and it's told for the first time, I think, in Nolan's career, from Oppenheimer's point of view. It's very much a perspective film.
Yeah.
And so we get the establishment of the base at Los Alamos in New Mexico. We move forward a decade and we sit in this awful airless side office in some government building during the McCarthyite Red Scare, and we watch as Oppenheimer is grilled by this committee of rabid commie hunters led by Jason Clarke's fervent lawyer. And then we get throughout this, the potted biography of the man himself, this complex, troubled individual who had, you know, he had this turmoil in his inner life. He couldn't remain faithful. He tried to murder a tutor at Cambridge. He was indecisive. When you think of a dreamer, and these are very difficult things to communicate almost without language. Murphy has to express this through his face.
That's
the merest, briefest sketch of what is very, very complicated.
Let's have a listen
to
a clip. This is developments in Europe are putting the scientists under pressure to make this bomb, and a businessman and naval officer, Lewis Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr., is asking for explanations.
Thanks for convening on short notice.
I can't believe it. Well, here we are.
This is atomic test.
The Russians have a bomb. We're supposed to be years ahead of them, but what were you guys doing in Los Alamos? And how many people were in these open discussions?
Too many. Compartmentalization was supposed to be the protocol.
We were in a race against the Nazis.
So now the race is against the Soviets.
Not unless we start it.
Robert, they just fired the starting gun.
So there you go. That's a clip from Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. And even within that clip, Tara, which is only 45 seconds long, I mean, there's a sense of tension across a lot of the 3 hours that's almost unbearable as you're watching it.
No, there's an incredible sense of propulsion. I mean, that's what it really has. I mean, even when someone is static and shot, the camera's moving. Like Hoytema's camera never stops moving. Like it's always tracking along beside someone. The dynamic, there's a dynamic editing. And then as you heard there, Ludvig Göransson's score is always like pounding along, propelling along. So like it's a really big bombast. fantastic film. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking. Like, it holds your attention far more for at least 2.5 hours anyway than a 3 hour film has any right to. But I do wonder, though, underneath all that, like, what exactly it has to say. Like, we've been talking about Barbie. Barbie had lots to say. I think, like, it has a very slippery character at the centre of it, and I'm not sure that Christopher Nolan's script has entirely got to grips with him. I think he remains a slippery character, and you walk in knowing exactly the same amount about Oppenheimer as you do leaving the cinema, I think. That's despite Murphy's Murphy's like incredible performance and whatnot. And I think one of the issues is, if you're making this film, which is about this absolute crossroads in terms of science and history and politics, because of course this invention actually marks the end of World War II and the start of the Cold War. But for a film that's at that crossroads, grapples very little with both science and politics.
Let John answer his point. He says disagrees.
I think he's really, the balance here is superb between the black and white sequences that Downey Jr. go, we go through the Washington D.C. chicanery and that intrigue and that this awful character who's trying to destroy Oppenheimer, and at the same time the we're asking moral questions about the creation of this weapon of mass destruction and how it's going to be used. And Nolan is very clear in how he sets out his thesis, which is, are scientists morally accountable for the use that politicians and military people make of their inventions? And he's very clear on that, I thought, all the way through.
Okay, well, there's one question that I do want to finish up with, Tara. There's much spoken about nude scene between Florence Pugh and Cillian Murphy. Was it needed?
No. No,
What is the big problem with
it? They've tried to stage it very cleverly, and it's really toe-curlingly embarrassing. There is also a real issue with the character Jean Tatlott that Florence Pugh's playing. Like she was an incredibly intelligent woman who was very influential on Oppenheimer's politics and on Oppenheimer himself, and she's reduced here to this like crying naked lady, which really isn't good enough.
Clean out of time. Stars from you, Tara.
3.5.
3.5. What are you saying, John?
I'm saying 5 stars here, Sean, and I don't say that very often, but this is the best film I've seen so far this year.
Difference of opinion, and I think Oppenheimer is going to cause that right across the nation, not just among our two reviewers. Oppenheimer and Barbie, the two films we got to talk about. We did talk about Alfred Hitchcock to director Mark Cousins earlier in the week, last week, so you can get that online. But that is our lot this evening. From Galway, Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Amandine Paso-Devine were the researchers. Kes Sheehy produced tonight's programme, and our thanks to both of our sound supervisors, Ruth Kennington in Dublin and John Doyle here in Galway. Back with you on Monday as usual here on RT Radio 1, 6:30 on Arena, and back at base on Monday. Yes, that's where I'll be. And now I'm going to go and watch The Pulse.